This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, listeners. If you're hearing this, I'm going to assume you're at least interested in money and understanding the economy and finances. And some of us want our kids to have that knowledge, too. Check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. You can learn more at greenlight.com/million and tune in to Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Here's how you know things in Europe haven't really been fixed. A day after it was announced, one day, that trillion-dollar bailout package looks like it might not be enough. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Deluxe Corp, a partner to more than 4 million small businesses with logo design, websites, email marketing, and online networking. Deluxe.com. And by Novo Nordisk, committed to changing diabetes through treatments, partnerships, and education. Defeating diabetes is our passion and our business.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl, and it is great to have you here on this Tuesday. It is the 11th of May today. Yesterday, about this time, the storyline out of Europe was that money really can buy you happiness. A nearly trillion-dollar rescue package had calmed global stock markets. Relief was palpable that the European debt crisis of 2010 would soon be little more than an unpleasant memory. Now that the markets have had a night to sleep on it, though, people are having some second thoughts. Marketplace's Elisa Roth explains what is making them unhappy.
The way a lot of investors see it, there's not much to be happy about. Europe's bailout might not be big enough, and it might not be implemented soon enough. Elsa Lignos is a currency strategist at RBC Capital Markets. She says this rescue won't do the job by itself.
This bailout package is not a panacea. It's not the solution to all of Europe's problems. It gives European countries with high debt, with deficit issues, it gives them some breathing space.
She says countries like Spain and Portugal need that breathing space so they can get their finances in order. But Greece has had disastrous results as it's been trying to cut costs and raise taxes. And Lignos says investors figure other countries might go the same way.
Both Spain and Portugal have so far been, you might call it, reluctant to undertake the necessary fiscal consolidation. And the measures that they have announced so far are not as aggressive as the market would like.
Investors are anxious about more than just Greece, Spain, and Portugal. Carl Weinberg is an economist at High Frequency Economics, and he says they're also worried about what Europe's problems could do to the rest of the world.
In a world where all financial institutions are linked, banks in Japan have credit relationship with banks in Europe. Banks in Germany have credit relationships with banks in Greece. So we have the risk of a rippled shock passing and expanding through the global financial system.
He says nobody believes the crisis in Greece is really under control yet, which makes them nervous about the situation in other countries, too. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
5 days after the votes were counted, the British election was made final today. Prime Minister Gordon Brown took about 5 minutes outside of number 10 Downing Street this afternoon to announce the results.
I've informed the Queen's private secretary that it's my intention to tender my resignation to the Queen. In the event that the Queen accepts, I shall advise her to invite the leader of the opposition to seek to form a government.
The Queen did accept Mr. Brown's resignation. She did invite the leader of the opposition, David Cameron, to form a government, which he has in coalition with the Liberal Democrats. And we have called our man in London, Stephen Beard, for more. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
What is the first thing Prime Minister Cameron's going to have to do now?
Cut the budget deficit. Both parties, both the Conservatives and their Liberal Democrat partners, made it clear over the past few days that repairing Britain's public finances will be their central concern. And certainly investors think that it should be their main concern. The UK's got the worst deficit of the G7 countries, and the European Commission says that if things go on as they are, the UK could have the worst deficit in the EU, worse even than Greece's, by the end of the year.
Which is obviously saying something. What's the market reaction going to be tomorrow when the markets open, Stephen?
Probably relief. Markets appear to regard this government as the most likely to be able to tackle the budget deficit. It's been interesting, you know, to watch the behaviour of the British pound, the currency, during the tortuous negotiations between the parties over the past few days. As the likelihood of a Conservative-Liberal coalition rose, so did the pound. When the prospect of a Labour-Liberal coalition emerged, the pound fell. So, yes, I would say markets will be relieved tomorrow.
Labour has been in power now, or was in power, I should say, for 13 years over there. How is this remarkable election going to change what happens over there?
I think the main thing is the state is going to get smaller. At the moment, government spending in the UK accounts for some 50% of economic activity. The budget deficit cutting is going to reduce that. But the Conservatives, anyway, are committed to shrinking the state. So a smaller state, bigger private sector. And we do seem likely to be heading into a period of some labour unrest. There are 6 million public sector workers bracing themselves for some big cuts. There will be a lot of resistance. And the Labour Party, now becoming the opposition, as you say, after 13 years in power, they seem certain to revert to their traditional role of fighting for the working people and for the union. So I would think we're heading into a period of some turbulence.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London for us. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Kai.
It was strangely calm in the equity markets today, given what the past couple of sessions have been like. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Ever since the Greek debt crisis started brewing a couple of months ago in the news, there have been comparisons to the United States, how the European Union is having to bail out one of its member states, while there are some American states in just as much trouble as the Greeks. Commentator Todd Buchholz says the analogy is more on the nose than we know.
I'm trying to figure out the difference between California and Greece. Our coastal climate is Mediterranean. Our governor used to look like Hercules. Our public employees threaten strikes, and our finances smell like yesterday's fish haul. Greeks must pay higher interest rates than Germans. And in Europe, it looks as if Germany and France will end up bailing out Greece. But who will bail out Californians? Texans? California's jobless rate is 12.6%, compared to just 8.2% for Texas. And it's not just a big state on the West Coast. Tiny states in the east, like Rhode Island, hobbled with a budget gap nearly 25% of state GDP. Here's the problem. States like Rhode Island, California, Massachusetts, New York, and New Jersey have been chasing away private jobs and paying public union employees too much. Each year, about 100,000 private workers in California pack up their woodies, strap surfboards to their roof, and drive east into the desert. Where there's no ocean, it's California, here we go. How do these states chase away jobs? Well, they all rank near the top for the highest tax rate. Because public pensions are so large, in some states it seems as if half the people go to work each morning just to prop up the other half. And the public workers, prison guards, teachers, nurses, asphalt repairmen, are highly organized and brilliant at scare tactics. In California, all Governor Schwarzenegger has to do is mumble through his cigar that we need to cut spending, and the radio airwaves buzz with slick commercials warning, Governor wants to pull the plug on grandma, fire great teachers, and then give felons jobs as school playground monitors. Schwarzenegger played kindergarten cop in the movies, but he's been under house arrest since he took office. Just like the rest of us in this golden state and states throughout the U.S. that better learn some lessons from the fall of Greece.
Economist Todd Buchholz was an advisor to the first President Bush. His most recent book is called New Ideas from Dead CEOs. Send us your thoughts, if you would. Go to marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Soft drink sales were down 2% in this country last year, so this month Coke is trying something new. What are being called freestyle soda fountains, machines that will let you mix and match more than 100 flavors. Just in case you ever wanted to pour yourself a fruit punch Coke or a diet raspberry Sprite. In the developing world, though, the key innovation for marketing soda is as simple as letting customers grab their own bottles. Gretchen Wilson reports now from Johannesburg, South Africa.
The neighborhood of Alexandra is only 3 square miles, but it is home to nearly 500,000 people. Most are unemployed. And here, people protect what little they have. You often find steel bars on the windows of shacks. Here, store owners keep even soft drinks behind bars. Often, they sleep in their shops with guns to prevent late-night raids.
Crime is an issue for this community.
Laurenti Matibe wants to change that. He works for ABI, the local bottler of Coca-Cola. His job is to get shops to sell more of his product. But how he does it tells a bigger story about trust and business in the world's poorest communities. At a local convenience store, Motibe points to an upright refrigerator branded with the Coke logo in front of the counter, right near the street, so anyone can grab their own soda.
You know, as we see, there's no security guards. There's nobody sitting and watching over the cooler.
Here, that's radical. A bottle of soda is only a dollar. But when you're broke, it's a luxury item. Motibe is persuading dozens of shop owners to put those new coolers in front of their stores and to trust consumers to pay instead of run. Patricia Ndlovu is a widow who's run the shop for 12 years. And she balked when he approached her 5 months ago.
A cooler outside, no.
Even when she got the fridge, she couldn't believe the company was serious.
They find me putting the cooler inside. They said, no, Mama, you're supposed to put the cooler outside. I said, no, because they are stealing it.
But she kept it outside, and not a single bottle has been stolen. Isaiah Sakwara likes choosing his own soda from the fridge.
As a customer, it shows they believe in us, so you definitely won't steal.
From India to Brazil, global businesses are finding profits by trusting consumers in the poorest communities in the developing world, what's known in business circles as the bottom of the pyramid.
There is actually spending power in that 4 billion people that were written off from formal marketing strategies.
Tashmia Ismail is with Gibbs, the business school of the University of Pretoria. She says the best bottom of the pyramid models are partnerships with local communities.
They get the benefit of income and employment. You get the benefit of building brand loyalty and a sustainable future market.
Of course, the bottler's real mission is to sell more soft drinks. But Laurenti Motibe says the way to do that is by empowering these shop owners.
We want to turn them into proper business people.
He's talking about people like Sam Sabila, who used to sell sodas out of his family refrigerator. ABI built up Sabila's storefront, gave him a street-side cooler, and started delivering to him directly. His soft drink sales have tripled. He says his wife can now buy whatever groceries she wants.
I afford to pay everything with the profit I get here. Yeah. I'm so proud.
Critics say the poor really need their money for education and healthcare, not consumer goods. But Motibe says building up microbusinesses and reducing crime is key to economic growth.
If we're serious about uplifting communities, this is what every single company should be doing.
ABI is already taking this model to other townships across the country. And among its advocates is Patricia Ndlovu, the skeptical widow who now sells $1,000 of soda every month. She's paying for her children to go to school.
I've been an example to other ladies that no matter even their husband is not there, but you can still pull up your socks and be a strong woman and work hard.
She says she never dreamed of this kind of success, but our new reputation for trusting people is paying off. In Alexandra, Johannesburg, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
Coming up, insomnia and the modern world.
So with each new technological change, you do find there's a focus on sleep.
As in not enough of it. But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks seesaw throughout the day, came to rest fairly close to where they started. The Dow Industrials ended trading 36 points lower, a third of 1%, 10,748 the number. The NASDAQ nudged up less than a single point, just a tiny fraction of 1%, 2375 at the bell. The S&P 500 slipped 3 points, a third of 1%, finished at 1155. Alcoa was one of the biggest weights on the Dow. Stock and the big aluminum producer lost more than 3.5% today. Analysts blamed inflation worries in China, which might reduce demand for raw materials there. Gold prices, on the other hand, hit an all-time high. Investors looking for a safe place to put their money pushed the price above $1,230 an ounce. That's a jump of almost 3%. Bond prices were nearly flat. The yield on the 10-year T-note edged down to 3.53%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at Elance.com. And by Vanguard, a client-owned company where the clients own the funds and the funds own the company. Learn more at Vanguard.com. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at the events coming up Wednesday. Film fans take note, the Cannes Film Festival kicks off in the south of France. It ends next Sunday. For the second day in a row, executives from BP, Halliburton, and Transocean head to the Hill and testify about the oil spill. This time it's before the House. And 10 years ago tomorrow, the Tate Modern Museum in London opened its doors for the very first time. I'm Kevin Ferguson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The oil slick in the Gulf of Mexico spilled into the halls of Congress today. Executives from BP and its drilling rig partners Transocean and Halliburton each tried to explain to the Senate Energy Committee how the whole thing wasn't their fault. Fingers were also pointed at the agency that regulates offshore drilling in this country, the Minerals Management Service. It's been accused of letting the oil industry set safety rules. So today, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar said it is time for a change. From Washington, Brett Neely has more.
The Minerals Management Service sets offshore safety standards, but it's also a cash cow that brings in $13 billion a year from oil drilling leases. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar's proposal would split the agency in two, following a regulatory model used by Norway and Australia. He said at a press conference today that one part would handle oil leases, the other safety.
So that there is no conflict, real or perceived.
In the past, safety and environmental regulations took second place to serving industry, says Mandy Smithberger. She's an investigator with the Project on Government Oversight.
I would say that the Minerals Management Service is probably one of the agencies of government that is most captured by the industry that it's supposed to be regulating.
A 2008 Interior Department investigation said the agency had a culture of ethical failure. The report said some employees used drugs and had sexual relationships with energy industry representatives. And it said the agency lacked the money or staff to be effective. That's one thing Salazar plans to beef up. But the big question is whether splitting MMS apart will be enough.
I'm skeptical that that will solve the problem.
Holly Doremus is an environmental law professor at UC Berkeley. She says this model will only work if you really clean the regulatory house.
You need to get people from a different orientation to start with, or you need some serious leadership from the top.
Salazar said today's proposed reforms for MMS are just the first of many. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Obviously, we're all losers from that spill. There is no upside to this kind of environmental damage, and there will be serious economic consequences along the Gulf Coast, too. But elsewhere, there are going to be some winners, as Rob Schmitz reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
The U.S. imports 90% of its shrimp, but if it came down to a popularity contest, our meager domestic supply would win, hands down. Just mentioning Gulf shrimp makes many seafood lovers salivate.
They have a different taste, a difference in flavor. They're really fresh, high-quality product.
Jack Isaacs is an economist for Louisiana's Department of Wildlife and Fisheries. Gulf shrimp, says Isaacs, is a brand. So who would move in if it's not there? Thailand, Indonesia, and Ecuador are the top shrimp exporters to the U.S. The spill is already impacting the Gulf's multi-billion dollar tourism industry. For years, tourists have driven by Georgia's coast on their way south. But now, says Bill Tipton, head of the Golden Isles Visitors Bureau, they're stopping.
We have been seeing an increase in folks looking at our area and basically telling us that they're opting out of the Gulf Coast because of the oil spill at this time. So we're trying to help them as much as we can. But we're also very sympathetic because we do understand it could be us just as easily if it slides around on our side.
Tipton says hotels in his region may start sharing a portion of their windfall bedroom tax with Gulf Coast hotels just to help out. Last, but certainly not least, oil companies are now looking to parts of the world where drilling isn't tied up with new government regulation. Some analysts are pointing to Canada with its reserves of oil sands. It's a thorny way to extract oil, but now it's not looking too bad. I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
We spend billions of dollars every year on medical tests, on the entirely reasonable theory that the more we know and the earlier we know it, the better off we're going to be. This week, Walgreens is trying to get some more of that money to come its way. This Friday, the drugstore chain will start selling genetic testing kits. Marketplace's Eve Trobe points out that in this case, a little knowledge may be a dangerous thing.
Walgreens will sell the Insight Saliva Collection Kit for $20 to $30. It contains a plastic tube that you spit in, and a box to send the sample to Pathway Genomics in San Diego.
The laboratory, you know, grinds through the saliva and puts a report together and then sends that back to the consumer.
Michael Nova is chief medical officer at Pathway. He says that report costs about $80 to $250, depending on what you want to know. You can find out how prone you might be to health conditions like diabetes or arthritis, whether you carry the gene for cystic fibrosis or Tay-Sachs disease, or how you might react to certain drugs that treat breast cancer or prevent blood clots. These types of tests have been around a few years from several companies, but they were only available online. Walgreens will carry the Pathway test in 6,000 stores. Edward Abrahams is president of the Personalized Medical Coalition. He says the drugstore chain will push genetic tests from a niche market to the mass market. Then it's up to consumers.
Whether the tests live up to what they claim to do and whether or not there is a market for them, both of those things are yet to be demonstrated.
The Food and Drug Administration is looking into whether it should regulate over-the-counter genetic tests. It doesn't think a small amount of DNA information should hold too much sway over people's medical decisions. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
A single bad night's sleep is one thing. You can power through the next day most times and get over it. But night after night of not sleeping is something else entirely. Patricia Morrisrow is well acquainted with the wee small hours of the morning. She's been an insomniac almost her whole life. And her new book about sleeplessness and the business of treating it is called Wide Awake, a memoir of insomnia. Patricia, it's good to have you here.
Thanks.
Are we, do you know, sleeping less as a society than we were, say, 50 years ago?
That's what they're saying, but there's no hardcore evidence. You know, in doing the research for this book, I went back and looked at, you know, newspaper accounts of sleep 100 years ago, and even at the dawn of industrialization, people were very, very worried. They say, oh my God, people are not sleeping. With each new technological change, you do find there's a focus on sleep. Having said that, I think with the increased travel, I know, for example, my husband last week was in 5 different countries in the Middle East. So I think you're getting much more of that, and that is really messing around with people's sleep.
When you first started researching this book, you did a little bit of a historical examination of the study of the science of sleep. And one of the things you discovered was that it's just not that long a history, is it?
You know, in the 50s and the 60s, it was pretty much dominated by psychiatrists. Psychiatrists would set up sleep labs, and they were hoping to study the mystery of dreams. And that really didn't pan out, because they discovered that what people were telling them in the lab after they woke them up really wasn't any more interesting than what they told them on the couch.
You actually took a night in a sleep lab as part of your treatment in this book. I imagine just being in that lab doesn't make you very inclined to sleep at all.
No, certainly not for me. I found the whole setup very, very uncomfortable. You know, the technician said to me, well, you know, if one of the wires comes unattached in the middle of the night, I'll just quietly come in and hopefully you won't wake up. And the answer is, if I were the type of person who didn't wake up when a strange man came into my room to remove electrodes, I would not be here.
Yeah.
So.
The modern medical answer to sleep problems these days is basically drugs, right? I mean, Ambien in the 80s, isn't that when it started?
Yeah, two-prong drugs and cognitive behavioral therapy. I think you can really pinpoint when the whole issue of America's major sleep problem, it very much started at the same time Searle introduced Ambien in 1991.
Do we know how big the sleeping pill industry is in this country?
$45 million people spend on sleeping pills, and I think in 2012 it's estimated that the number will go up to something like $3.9 billion.
And does it work?
Sleeping pills can be much more successful for people if they need them for what they call sleep onset insomnia, meaning you have a difficult time falling asleep, but they're much less successful in terms of keeping you asleep. And I was very surprised when I was looking at some of the clinical studies that they only provide 11.5 minutes of extra sleep over placebo.
Is the sleep industry at large sort of making plans to adjust to these lifestyles we have that are increasingly fractured and frenzied and just busier and busier?
A couple of days ago, I saw something for dream water. Sleep is just a sip away.
Oh, geez.
So, you know, it's that type of thing. It's so pervasive. It's not only sleeping pills. It's down to more and more complicated mattresses that we need. You know, sleep is a very natural process, but you wouldn't know it by all the gimmicks out there.
Patricia Morrisrow, her memoir of insomnia is called Wide Awake. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
A final note this afternoon, SEC Chairwoman Mary Shapiro told a congressional hearing today that regulators are pretty sure Thursday's market crash wasn't the result of a fat-fingered error, that is, one trader just making a really, really expensive typo. Also, that the computers running the markets were working just fine. That kind of raises this question, though. If there wasn't an actual technical glitch or a human error, then why, do you suppose, has the NASDAQ canceled more than 10,000 trades from Thursday afternoon? A friend of mine said today that the U.S. stock market is held together with not much more than bubblegum and paperclips. Think about that for a second. And while you do that, is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 36 points. That's a third of 1%. The NASDAQ rose less than a point. We'll call that flat. The S&P 500 dropped 3 points. That is a third of 1%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Ethan Lindsay on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid, and that's where you can tune tomorrow morning for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this broadcast, the most unlikely candidate for an international trade dispute ever, the catfish industry.
You know, I have a fear if the foreign fish is left unchecked and it keeps coming in here, it could bleed over into the domestic industry.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.